live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back, the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And anytime we have someone on location, especially, I don't know where he's at right now, we're all talking about what I'm really excited to welcome to the program, celebrity Dan DeLuca. He plays Jack Kelly for the hit Broadway series Disney's Newsies, and it's really exciting. It's an award winning smash hit musical that'll be coming to Pittsburgh Tuesday, November 25th to Sunday, November 30th at the Benenum. Dan, how are you? And thanks for calling. And where are you right now, by the way, Dan?
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for calling me. I'm actually in the Nemesis. I'm in Cleveland right now, which is not great for Pittsburgh people, but I'm in Cleveland right now.
So you have shows in Cleveland right now, by the way.
Yeah, we're here for 2 weeks, which is nice. We get settled down. We do a lot of 1 week engagements, but we do have some month long sit downs. Like in Pittsburgh, we're only there for a week, but we're there over Thanksgiving, which is lovely for me because I can have family time at Thanksgiving, so that's nice.
You get to be home with the family, and that's nice for sure to be able to do that, especially when do you get that? Is when you've been traveling all over the United States for this. So how excited were you when you finally got cast for this, man?
Oh, my goodness. It's very hard to put into words. I was beyond ecstatic. I was thrilled. My agents called me, and the casting director called me, and they knew how much this show and this role meant to me. I've been going in for the show, for this character for over 2 years now, and my opportunity finally came, and I it was crazy. I still feel like the happiest and the luckiest guy in the world.
Was that your big break, would you say, or you've been playing some other big roles doing some of these series? What would you say? Yeah,
I would say this is definitely a big breakthrough role for me as far as industry goes. I've been working regionally around the country and stuff like that since I finished school last year. However, this is the first big Broadway tour that I've ever done, and to be able to be in the lead role and to be leading this company is quite an honor. So this is a big thing for me.
And to come to Pittsburgh, what an amazing thing to be able to come to Pittsburgh during the holidays as the lead role. So tell us a bit about this. Again, I was doing some research on Newsies, but I find it very fascinating for sure. And you play Jack Kelly. Tell us a little bit about Jack.
All right. Jack Kelly is the charismatic, rebellious leader of the Newsboys. He's a like big brother to all of them. He watches over all of them as, you know, his own responsibility. He's a kid of the streets. He's a charmer. He's a bit cocky. He's a ladies' man. But deep down, he's really romantic, and he's quite the dreamer, and he dreams of a life far away from the streets of New York City and really wants to get away to this magical place he calls Santa Fe, where he wants to be a cowboy. So you see him wrestle with that throughout the entirety of the show. Going on strike.
And that's the interesting story. The storyline is the strike. Basically, a newsboy, basically, in that time, that's how they were making their living, and especially in a rough economic time at that point, right, to try to make ends meet.
Absolutely. You'll see the show starts. We're actually starting in a newsboy's lodge house. A lot of us are orphans, so we're having to, you know, make ends meet by selling these papers. And the whole idea of the show is Pulitzer and Hearst, the newspaper publishing titans of the time, raised the price of papers without consulting us, and it's at our expense. And we, you know, we stand up and we're like, no, this is not okay, because how are we supposed to make a living? And it's a true story, too. I'm not sure if the listeners know that, but it's a true story, the strike of 1899.
And that's at a time when economics, I mean, we're getting close to the Depression, but yet still for people who are the lower class, because at that point, the reason why the Depression happened is because of the rich, especially these rich newspaper companies, were basically employing people for hardly anything. And this is before the unions really took hold and things like that. So your character decided to stand up to them, right?
Yeah, with the help of all of the friends, with all of his friends, he's like, all right, we know what, we need to stand up for what we believe in. Like, this is not right. And it's amazing how this is a true story. These 13 and 14 year old boys gather the entirety of New York City to strike against these the most powerful men in the city at the time, and they end up winning. They join their, they make their own union. They decide, hey, we're a union now. This is what we ask, and they come up with a compromise that everyone can live with.
And hearing the story and thinking about it, especially, it's interesting to say it's a musical, right? I mean, you're mm-hmm. hearing a story that this could be definitely taught in the history classrooms. This could be taught in the schools for sure. And that definitely fits into my education portion of my network because, I mean, people just didn't know, especially when talking about kids and then we're also talking about the strike and how economic times were. Do you guys speak to a lot of schools and stuff about this story and stuff? Do you get to out there?
I think it's definitely getting out there. I know there's study guide sheets that go to certain schools, and we do outreach programs with different schools that in the cities that we go to. It's strange because I feel like it's a very important story that's not told a lot, especially
yes.
for our younger generations to hear about how these kids, you know, stood up to, you know, they stood up for what they believed in. You know, a lot of people think like a lot of kids are on, you know, their phones all the time and stuff like that and not really caring about what's happening in the world, where, you know, I think it's very important for all of the younger generations to hear this story of like, wow, you can really make a difference if you set your heart on what you believe in and you know what's right.
Yeah, make that difference, and for kids to say that you don't have to always take what's happening. If things are not going well in your life, you need to speak up. You need to mm-hmm. speak up because you guys have to be some sort of voice. And from, I guess, the organization of the Newsies getting together, we'll have to find out by watching the show for sure and going, especially our Pittsburgh audience, but traveling all over the country to check you out and check where you're what's going on with you. So in this process, what do you think has been your favorite thing in this performance? How long have you been traveling with the group right now, and how many shows have you done so far since you got this role?
I strangely don't even know the number how many shows we've done, but we started rehearsals in the beginning of September, and we've been on the road since early October, so not that long yet, but it has been quite an adventure so far. It's been a total blast. I'm also a huge Disney geek. So, you know, my bosses are like, the man who wrote the music was the guy who wrote Beauty and the Beast,
oh, wow.
Aladdin, The Little Mermaid, and that's Alan Menken.
You know, so you're hoping at one point you get those jobs, right? that's
I mean, it's not a bad guy to know, absolutely. and just, you know, working for this creative team, Harvey Fierstein, you know, the book writer, you know, everyone knows him by his voice.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, just like working with them, it's just been incredible. You know, it's kind of like, and it's also the ultimate Disney dream underdog role, because, you know, I get to be like a dirty street kid who gets to sing all these like powerful, like awesome melodies while like getting to kiss girls at the same time. It's not a bad gig at all.
Oh, I definitely think it's not a bad gig, and then it gets you into the mix of this for sure. And what would you say, how is it difficult it is, and I've talked to people about being in Broadway and stuff like that, to get up and work every night, work almost every day, and then constantly do the show, and to keep yourself motivated to perform the very best every night, especially with
yeah.
the travel and everything involved?
Yeah, what people don't see on stage is that, you know, people see us having fun and having, like, and singing and dancing and all this stuff. But what they don't see is the process that we have to go through the entire day to get us ready for the show. Because, you know, what we're exuding up there is our own energy. It's our own bodies. You know, we're not just, we have to prepare the entire day, making sure we get enough sleep, making sure we have the vocal technique to sing the show healthily every night, and, you know, making sure our bodies are warm. So that we can dance, you know, dance the show every night, because it's so easy to, you know, to get hurt. We only have one body, you know what I mean? So, like, and those are our money makers. But it's, you know, it's something that, you know, we all enjoy, so it's not that terrible. But, you know, sometimes I'm not allowed to speak all day because I have two shows the next day or something like that. So it's a lot harder than it looks, I must say. I mean, it's great fun, obviously, and it's a dream, but, you know, it's not an easy thing that we do.
I've talked to so many celebrities that, you know, have been on the screen, television, and then acting, and they say they enjoy the theater the most. And I think it's because of the unexpected, that basically you are impromptu in so many ways. You go on and you go and do film, you're going to take 52,000 takes. You go ahead and do television, same thing. But when you're on stage, there's only one take, and that's it. And I think that really changes the perspective for sure.
It's quite thrilling I get a thrill from it also, because there's like a new audience every night, some people have never seen the show before. But yeah, I mean, as I mentioned before, we are human beings. There are human beings calling the show, so there are there's going to be mishaps. People are going to forget their lines sometimes, but I mean, we were hired, you know, to also like take care of those situations in case they arise. Because it's happened before. We've had to stop the show before just for, like, technical difficulties or, you know, if someone forgets a line and we have to do a little improv session, you know. But hopefully the audience doesn't know. So, but it's so much fun.
So we have about 2 minutes left. Dan, what is new with you after this? Do you have any other projects coming up? Do you have plans after this is over, after the whole run? What are you planning on doing?
I mean, honestly, I'm on contract till the next October, so I'm doing this for an entire year.
Oh,
so I cannot even think about what's happening next. So I'm just, like, really having to just, like, drink in this moment right now. But I am so thrilled to come to Pittsburgh. We're playing the Benenham Center, which is where I saw my first show ever. And I am just beside myself, you know, just trying to I'm so excited.
Did you ever play the Benenham in certain ways, in one role, a little small role or stuff? Like for the.
I've been backstage. I've never even been on the stage. So I am so thrilled that I can make my my dream role debut in my hometown and on the Benenham stage. It's such a thrill, and I think about it every day. And I'm so excited to bring it to you guys.
Fantastic, Dan. Where's the best place we can find you? I know that you have a Twitter. Do you have a website of your own, or just a Twitter where people can follow you, and then I'll tell where they can purchase tickets and stuff?
Twitter, Instagram for sure. I don't have an official website. We're still working on that right now. But definitely Twitter and Instagram. I also have a fan page on Facebook. If you just look up Dan DeLuca, my fan page is on there.
Well, fantastic. People can purchase tickets by going to trustarcs.org or call 412-471-6930. And remember, it's November 25th to Sunday, November 30th, Tuesday through Thursday, 7:30, Sunday, 6:30, Friday, Saturday, 8 p.m., and matinees, 2 and 3 o'clock, 1 o'clock, Saturday and Sunday. So it's good talking to you, Dan. Best of luck, and I hope to see you in Pittsburgh sometime. So take care, man.
Yeah, thanks so much. My pleasure. Have a great day.
You too, Dan. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. You got to go Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google+, Neil Haley, for all the great places. And again, it's all about the Miami Book Fair. And this is the Miami Book Fair series on Author's Corner. And to remember to attend the Miami Book Fair November 16th to 23rd. 21st to 23rd will be the great street fair. I will be broadcasting live with Eric Remmel of Life Improvement Radio from November 22nd and November 23rd from 9 to 2 o'clock. Can't wait. So I'm excited to welcome the program. And this is just a very, very interesting interview, to say the least. New York Times bestselling author, Pulitzer Prize winning biographer, Kai Bird, author of Good Spy, The Life and Death of Robert Ames. Kai, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm good, Neil. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, absolutely, Kai. And we were talking off air, and you said you're from Miami Beach, or you're calling from Miami Beach. This will be your first time attending and being a participant at the Miami Book Fair. How excited are you?
Oh, I'm very excited. I gather it's the biggest book festival in the country these days, and I've gone to quite a few, so I'm looking forward to this one.
Well, absolutely, and what an amazing event it is to, you know, connect the great authors with the fans, and everyone gets to kind of really celebrate books for that whole week, and I think that's fantastic.
Yes, it's very important.
Oh, it's definitely very, very important, Kai, and to get to these great authors. But let's now go into the book, the Life and Death of Robert Ames. Now, first of all, it was very surprising doing the research and specific things of why you wrote about him. Tell us a little bit about that, and then we're going to get right into specifically the time period you wrote about and things like that.
Okay, well, Robert Ames was a CIA officer from 1960 until 1983, and as it happens, I knew him when I was 11, 12, and 13 years old. He was our next-door neighbor in Dahran, Saudi Arabia, where my father was a Foreign Service officer stationed there, and Ames was our neighbor, and I had no idea as a young adolescent that he was a CIA officer, but I later learned this. And so this, he always, you know, I have vivid memories of him. And when he died tragically in Beirut in 1983, you know, that stuck with me. And so about 4 years ago, I started to do a full-scale biography of him.
And that involved a lot of research, for sure, especially thinking that time period and also thinking about being in the CIA and a lot of mystery to have to uncover to learn more about him, for sure.
Oh, yeah. No, it was very difficult. Initially, I really didn't think I could do an in-depth biography, but I found more than 40 CIA retired officers who had known Ames, and they wanted to tell their stories. So I have 30 and 40-year-old secrets here in the book, and it's just a fantastic tale where, you know, Ames is known inside the CIA for having been the first officer to penetrate the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization, in 1969 by forming a friendship with a very colorful young Palestinian operative named, who was sort of known as the Red Prince, Ali Hassan Salameh. And he was Yasser Arafat's chief bodyguard and virtual intelligence chief. And, yeah, well, was a dangerous man, a man who walked around with a pistol in his belt. And yet he was providing sort of aims at a window onto the PLO at a time when there were no contacts between the U.S. government and the PLO, because it was regarded and listed as a terrorist organization.
Right, exactly, yeah. And Kai, how did he make those connections, make those friendships, especially when we, you know, we see our war on terror now, and really it's very difficult to make those connections, especially with hatred that's going on in our world today, especially in the Middle East. But how was he able to do that, to make those connections so he could find out what was really going on in these places?
Well, I call him the good spy because he was exactly that. He was very good at his work. He was also, as it happens, a very decent man, who loved his wife and six children, and he was sort of very much an all-American, low-key kind of fellow. But if you read The Good Spy, you'll acquire a new appreciation for the value of human intelligence, meaning direct one-to-one relationships between people. And, you know, we've been told a lot since 9/11 that our national security depends on intercept intelligence, you know, sophisticated intercepts of our emails and telephones and by the NSA, as Ed Snowden has revealed to us in recent years. But if you read The Good Spy, you'll suddenly have some doubts about all that, because intercept intelligence cannot give you a window onto human intentions or motivations. And this is what Ames did with his career. He was very good at just forming friendships with people in dangerous neighborhoods. And this allowed him to get very close to, you know, the Red Prince in the PLO, Ali Hassan Salameh. And this also sort of inside the CIA, he's credited for having, through this relationship, he's credited with having jump-started, planted the seeds of the whole Oslo peace process. He first got Palestinians to talk to the Americans, and that led eventually to Palestinians talking to the Israelis. So, and this is, you know, this is sort of a classic intelligence story. Ames was able to go where a conventional diplomat could not.
And why, after his death, have not many people try to follow his lead of how he was able to, you know, to make connections to see what's going on specifically instead of, you know, the I guess later on the times of waterboarding and the Bush administration.
Yeah, well, the CIA has become a very different organization from what it was 30, 40 years ago. And this is, I argue in the book, it's a shame. They've gotten off track. They no longer do what they were formed to do, which was intelligence gathering on a one-to-one basis, human intelligence. And instead, they're now, since 9/11, they're in the business of targeted assassinations with, you know, drones. They run the drone program. So that makes it very hard for them to, you know, send clandestine officers into the streets of Beirut or Tehran or Jerusalem and, you know, make friendships, recruit people, because they know that, you know, the clandestine officer is a representative of the CIA, which is in the business of assassination. So it's a little counterproductive.
To be able to build that trust, and once, Robert Ames was killed in Beirut in 1983, do you think that's it just was the downhill slide after that fact? No one could replace Robert in that type of a role in certain ways, and that certain thing?
It was, you know, it was a tragic story, and I go into great depth about how it happened and who orchestrated this first truck bomb attack on a U.S. embassy. But after that embassy attack, in which 8 CIA officers and 17 Americans altogether were killed, you know, the Middle East began to go downhill. It was a major turning point. Then 6 months later, there was a similar attack on the Marine barracks in Beirut, and 241 Marines servicemen died. And, you know, the Middle East has never really been the same since. It's gotten more extreme. And we've allowed this Palestinian-Israeli conflict to fester.
Yes.
And festering causes more animosity, and it breeds more violence and hatred. And, you know, it's a real, we're really at a stalemate now, even today. So that's why I in the book, arguing that, you know, Ames's work, while he was attempting to be a peacemaker, his work is obviously unfinished.
It definitely is. What would you do, Kai, from your research and, I guess, an opinion as a journalist as well, through this researching Robert's life and specific things, say, how can we stop this festering of the Palestinian relationship with Israel and stuff? What would you suggest?
Well, it's no secret. Everyone knows the compromise that's necessary. It's the same compromise that Ames was trying to persuade Ali Hassan Salameh and Arafat in the 1970s to go in that direction, a two-state solution. And we know even what the map would look like. The Israelis have to make a decision. They are the ones in charge now. They control, you know, all the land and the peoples between the River Jordan and the Mediterranean. And if they want to come to a peace with the Palestinians, it's quite clear that the PLO is now willing to endorse the concept of a separate Palestinian state on a part of Palestine, and that would be in the occupied territories in Gaza. But as, you know, everyone remembers, this last year, our Secretary of State has spent a lot of time and effort and failed to get the parties to agree. And I'm afraid the time is running out. The demographics are such that, you know, the Israelis are continuing to build settlements on the West Bank, and that's going to make it very difficult to imagine where there'd be any room for a Palestinian state.
Right. And especially if our political changes in our country, that the landscape of things, that if we don't get this done by now and that get them to compromise in a way that's going to work for both parties in the right way, we're going to constantly see this conflict continue over and over and again for years to come. and that the violence will continue, and more innocent lives people will die, and that's terrible, and there won't be peace in that area for sure. Kai, I'm sure that the book coming out this time is a perfect time, especially with, you know, just different things going on in the Middle East in dialogue. I'm sure you've been asked to talk about specific conflicts or different things going on in the entire Middle East through your research and stuff, haven't you?
Yes. Mm-hmm. No, it's always this is the tragedy, alas. You know, you bring out a book about the Middle East and you know inevitably it's going to be timely because there's always some crisis out there.
Exactly. And definitely places. So people can go purchase your book, Where, Kai, and learn more about you. Where can they go?
Well, it's in Books and Books here in Miami, the very good independent bookstore that hosts actually the Miami Book Festival. But you can find it in any major bookstore and, of course, online from any of the major online sellers, from Amazon to Powell's Books or whatnot. And it's gotten terrific reviews, and I'm really kind of astonished at how much of a window it provides onto a sort of shadowy world of intelligence.
Absolutely,
it's a spy thriller, but it's all true.
All true, a spy thriller that's all true. And then Kai, your success. Do you have a website as well for people to find info on you?
I'm sorry?
Do you have a website, Kai, that people can go to?
Oh, I do have a website, yes. It's just www.kaibird.com, KAIBIRD.
Well, have a blast in Miami, and enjoy yourself at the book fair, and I'm sure people are going to have tons of questions for you, the fans, especially book signings and different things about what's going on in the Middle East and what you would do to hopefully stop this entire violence that's happening throughout the Middle East. So you've got a lot of information from that research, and definitely we'll be sharing it with the fans in Miami. So thanks again for calling.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right, take care, Kai. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network again. TotalTutor.net for more information. Again, Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, Total Tutor, and Pinterest, Neil Haley, and also Google Plus, you can check me out at Neil Haley, and it's all about the Miami Book Fair, the Miami Book Fair series. That's what Authors Corner has been doing, covering Miami Book Fair authors all the way up to the book fair, which will be November 16th to 23rd. The 21st to 23rd will be the street fair. And I will be broadcasting live from November 22nd to 23rd. For more information, go to miamibookfair.com or go to my website, totalturner.net. And this story is amazing. This definitely touches my heart in the journey that this person has gone through. So I'm so excited to welcome the program acclaimed memoirist, Beverly D'Onofrio, author of Astonished. Beverly, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Absolutely. And the rest of the story is a story of healing and finding grace. And will this be your first time at the Miami Book Fair, attending as a participant?
Yes, my very first time. I'm excited.
I mean, it's something about going into these book fairs and connecting with your fans, right? That's probably one of the things that really makes it fun to go to these, right?
Yeah, hearing other authors, going to a party, having to get dressed up.
Yeah.
And getting to read my book in front of people.
Absolutely. And that's where your labor of love of going down there and finally saying, I'm going to go ahead and write this story down on paper, even though it's very difficult, as we're going to talk about your story, and say, now I get to share it with others, and now I get to see people. When you're in your office writing on a notepad or a napkin, your authors are unseen. It's not like, you know, when you perform as an athlete, you're in front
of... Well, most of us like that, though. I mean, I certainly am probably more introvert than extrovert. But it's really good to go dip my toe into the world and to see people to kind of keep myself normal.
Absolutely. As normal as you can be, Beverly, in your life. So tell us.
Right.
So basically the story again starts out about your experience in Mexico, which was very, very tough. So just the,
eight years ago, I was raped by a serial rapist in my own bed. I awoke to him with a knife at my throat saying, don't scream, I have a knife. It wasn't as terrifying as it might seem, because he had raped four other women before, and I knew their stories, which was that he wouldn't harm me, aside from raping me, if I didn't fight. So I knew he wasn't going to use the knife. It wasn't like a horror story. And for me, at that moment, I was looking for a monastery to join. My life had turned flat, and I was thinking I really wanted to infuse it with spirituality. I wanted to get closer to God, however I could imagine that, and was looking for a monastery. And so when I awoke to a rapist, I thought, now, God, now you send a rapist to my bed? And I didn't know if I would be able to forgive God. Not that I really thought God sent a rapist, but in that moment, you know, it was all about God. It was like, what is happening to me?
We don't think
that began the journey.
Absolutely, Beverly. And I have definitely some questions about your faith at that point in time before this happens. But I think what really is interesting is we sometimes forget about God all together. But when something really bad happens, said, where were you, God? You know, and all the good things that happen in our lives, or the things we look at that are positive in our lives, we don't say, well, thank you, God. You know, but when something bad happens, it's all your fault. And
well,
I'm going
to. Yeah. And it's also when we're afraid, we want to believe that there's something bigger than us that can affect things. Even if you think, even in the moment, if it's a bad thing, it's like God is present. God is more present in our pain and our anguish than ever in our lives.
Absolutely. And I can't imagine. So at this journey being here, you were trying to find a monastery and you were raped. So basically your whole life, did you have a strong faith before that? Before this?
Pardon, what did you say?
Did you have a strong faith in God before this?
Well, yes, I had come to God through the Virgin Mary. I began to collecting her at yard sales. This was my second book, and I wanted to believe in God, didn't believe in God, and got there through really trying and praying and going to Virgin Mary apparition sites. And so that had been like a decade before, and you know, the conversion experience was like a white hot fire, and then everything just kind of calmed down, and I was in a gray period for a while, and I wanted to get back to, you know, having life in my everyday, to turn the quotidian divine, to make life significant, to, you know, make little things sacred and have ritual. And so that's why I was going to a monastery. And what happened, you know, with this rape was it gave me everything I wanted. Of course, in the moment, I didn't know it, but after it happened, I thought, all right, this is an opportunity, because it's like a liminal space that mystics talk about, where time slows down and you have no idea how this is going to fit into the tapestry of your life, but you know this is an important thing. And I used it. You know, I took control. I knew that it would change me, but I was going to try to make it as good an experience as I could. So I went off to these monasteries and I studied mystics and I read and I prayed and I walked in nature and I took a mystical view of things, which is kind of like what poets do. You know, you stop and you look at the underside, and it really did change my view of life. And I don't know that it changed me. I'm still kind of a curmudgeon and I'm not, you know, particularly a nice person, but it gave me more peace.
Interesting. And again, you're wrestling with your anger issues at this time because of why it happened. And then through that, you decided a journey of going through prayer. It's very interesting. We talked about the Blessed Virgin Mary and different situations and what you went through. One thing that they talk about, especially Catholics do, Saint John the Cross talked about, there's that dark period in your faith where you literally
feel dark night of the soul when everything gets dry. Everybody goes through it, you know. And you know what happened on this journey of recovery, really, I had PTSD. I was terrified. every night, not every night, but every week at least once I would have a dream that I would wake up from this dream believing that the rapist was in my room, and it was not logical. And really writing about the experience, I think, is what brought me to the other side, writing about God and writing about the trauma.
Exactly.
And,
yeah.
And it's, you know, they're using it, veterans groups are using writing as a form of therapy, and it really, really does work. Also, it's like there's this Native American tale that I really love. It's an old wise man, and he says to his grandson, I have two things inside of me. I have good, which is, you know, kindness and love and peace, and I have evil, which is anger and violence. And he said, and the grandson says, so which is winning? And he says, whichever one I feed.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I knew that it was kind of like, I mean, I really wanted to understand what evil was and how it could exist in a world that I conceived of as created in love. And the conclusion that, I don't know, maybe there's evil in God. You know, if God is everything, then who am I to even understand? I don't know. So I kind of came to peace with it. And I look at it now as, like, I was washing dishes at my father's house, and I was about to put the water in the dishpan, and I saw an ant in it. And I brought it out and dumped the ant out onto the grass on the lawn, and I thought, well, that's what happened to me. It was like, you know, the ant was in one place, and then it was in another, and through the rape.
Yes.
That's what I got. It was kind of like when it happened, I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to be changed forever.
Right.
And then afterwards, I thought, well, why wouldn't I want to be changed by a powerful experience?
Interesting when you talk about there is evil in God, there meaning evil in this world, evil before, if your faith is first definitely heaven, and that this is just a place to, this is, as I think St. Teresa of Avila said, basically that it's a night in a dark inn. It's like that, a bad night in a dark inn, that this type of our lives in general, we're going to suffer in specific times and places, and we have to trust God why we're going through all this and stuff.
Exactly.
So yeah, go ahead.
Pain is a place of breakthrough. I mean, I teach writing workshops and memoir writing workshops, and it's all about getting the writers to go to the pain.
Exactly.
And if, as Richard Rohr says, if you don't transform it, you'll transmit it. And, you know, we all want to avoid it, but life is just filled with it. And the path of wisdom is through suffering. Great love and great suffering are the pathways to God.
Yes.
They're what make you wise.
The saints suffered a ton. The saints believed in that pain is good, that pain is part of this process, that we have to suffer as Jesus suffered. So interesting. So you, in that journey of all those monasteries, people, I know you have to read the book, but this just interests me. I wish I had a lot more time to talk to you today, Beverly. But basically in that process, where are you spiritually now? You went through that prayer time. You found grace.
Now I have moved to Woodstock and almost immediately met a woman who told me I was at a writer's conference. She sat down next to me and said, she was there to see Beverly D'Onofrio. I said, I'm Beverly D'Onofrio. And she said, oh my God, I read your book. I loved it. I'm in a rosary group. Do you want to come? And so I go to this rosary group every Thursday evening. It's run by this, Buddhist scholar, Clark Strand, who has come back to his Christian roots because he was with his family on an airplane. They thought they were dying, and he prayed to God. And he thought, I pray to God. I believe in God. And it kind of revolutionized his whole view of the world. And we say the rosary, and it's kind of like I had wished that I was an alcoholic because I wanted to go to Alcoholics Anonymous because they're the most spiritual people I know. And this is like, you know, a rosary kind of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, we ask for what we need. We say our petitions. We all pray together. We pray for each other. We talk about the mysteries of the rosary. And And it's just beautiful.
How tremendous. How tremendous.
Yeah,
and
really.
To get this message out in Miami, fantastic. I think people are definitely going to be quite interested in this story. And you definitely have transformed yourself as a writer through a horrible experience, to say the least. But I think it's made you another journey in your life for sure. And God always brings us on these journeys. So, Beverly, where's the best place we can purchase your book and learn more about you?
Well, I have a website, beverlydonofrio.com, and there are places there where I think that it'll bring you to Amazon or to the, I don't know where it brings you to, but you can purchase it that way, or you can go to your local bookstore and ask them to order it, or you can get it from amazon.com.
All right. Well, thanks for calling. Have fun
Thank
in
you.
Miami, and we'll definitely stay in touch. And I want to connect with you. Definitely, two spiritual people like ourselves together in our process and journey to where we want to end up. So, thanks.
What
again
a
for
wonderful
calling.
Talk! Thank you so much, Neil.
You're welcome. Take care, Beverly.
Okay,
see
you too. Bye bye.
Okay, bye bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And I tell you, the buzz continues to go about Dinkins Ethic Training, about Dynamite Sports, and in our segments. And I've been going through the book written and compiled by Rick Wire, The Student Athlete and College Recruiting. And amazing enough, we've covered a lot of the topics. I might have to go into greater detail, but there's so much news involving this process and thinking about it as a student athlete and, again, a top recruited student athlete and NFL player. So I want to welcome to the program Super Bowl champion, 9-year NFL veteran, plus Pitt star, Darnell Dinkins. Darnell, how are you?
Hey, pleasure to be on the show, man. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic, except the weather. I mean, we went from 70 degrees down to 35, but that's Pittsburgh in November, and we're getting close to Turkey Day, so we have to understand it can't be. We have to get the winter coats out and get going for sure. And but for our listeners all over the world, as I keep telling you, we're not just getting heard in Pittsburgh; we're getting heard all over the world, especially different radio stations and different things. There are definitely possibilities for international students to play college sports. Isn't that correct? Especially we see this a lot going on in basketball and hockey and all those different things. So that's our topic for today.
Absolutely. Well, hockey, with soccer, where, you know, in baseball, there's greater demand for international athletes with volleyball. So the main thing is making sure these kids are identified, you know, early in our 8th and 9th grade years. And then on the compliance, and it takes a little bit more for these schools to make sure these kids are compliant, make sure they can, you know, speak the language, whatever school they're going to, so they will ultimately won't be too far behind the eight ball when they carry over. Some kids, those schools will have things set up for these kids for interpreters so that, you know, once they get here, they can actually communicate with the coaches and or the players. But definitely with the rise in soccer, volleyball, track, you know, baseball, there's a great demand for international athletes, not just athletes within the United States.
Definitely. And in that process, they're definitely, the NCAA is watching them like hawks, especially when we're talking about some of the international areas where, you know, they could have been already a professional athlete. And I don't know how they get away with certain looking at those specific teams or those club teams that possibly pay different things. So parents out there listening about their international athlete, what are the rules, especially with the NCAA, when it comes to an international athlete? Because there's more opportunity, definitely, for them to already be a professional in certain aspects.
Exactly. Well, the biggest thing is to make sure they don't lose their amateurism, which is getting paid for certain, you know, events and or, you know, things. So they want to make sure that they keep their amateur status good, and then at the end of the day, you know, they will make sure from a compliance standpoint that they fit all requirements via the NCAA. Now, there's different parameters when you're dealing with that the international type athlete, but most of the time the school board, when they get a kid over, they understand what he'll be, they start making sure from a compliance and academic standpoint that that kid has everything he needs to be academically eligible once he moves on to college.
And that process, especially when we're talking about college visits, things like that, how is that done, especially when we're talking about kids traveling from overseas? A lot of times they have played in the States before, right? They've ended up maybe possibly being on a club team or something like that, right?
Some of them have played in the States before, some have not. And so the main thing when you're going through, you know, the recruiting process and, you know, taking visits, there's a different, you know, a small protocol, but not too extreme, you know, for these international athletes. And pretty much it will entail the coaches being involved, the administration being involved, to make sure that once the kid, you know, gets here, he can, you know, have interpreters on hand. He can, you know, do all the things he needs to and make sure academically he's sound. So once he decides to go to that school, he's good to go.
Definitely. And once you're good to go, you're golden on the next thing for sure. And a lot of families out there looking. Have you dealt with it in football that much? Are there many international players playing football?
Not many international players playing football, but you'll see it more in volleyball and soccer and in track, you know, with a lot of kids coming from the islands, Jamaica, you know, things like that. So, you know, the international standards play more of a factor, and obviously with basketball, some guys, you know, playing their countries and coming over. But the biggest thing with these kids playing in different sports is the fact that they do not lose their amateur status. As certain parameters, you know, surround these kids, you look at, you know, a lot of Asian kids who come from over, they go into different type of school settings where things are paid, trainers paid, so you need to make sure they don't break any parameters of their amateur status moving on to college.
And how does the NCAA police that in certain ways to make sure that
look at the track record of all things that have been given and make sure that the things that are done are being done on the academic side things first, and then make sure it's not solely for athletics.
And from going and speaking across the U.S. about this and stuff like that, and also talking to Rick about it and the specifics, are there any stories that you've heard about involving the international athlete and what they go through in this process?
For some, you know, just the protocol of more than anything, being able to communicate with different you know, coaches. And that's the biggest thing with international athletes. If there has been some at Pitt, there's been some at other schools, but at the end of the day, they want to make sure that the coach can obviously interpret what they say, because the kid want to be able to not only just be here, but want to be able to participate in the plays, do the plays, whether it's basketball, whether it's football, you know, whether it's, you know, soccer. They need to be able to communicate with their teammates. Communication is the biggest part of any sport. So the interpretation piece is the biggest factor that I've seen from any athlete coming over. They cannot fluently speak English. That usually ends up being the biggest deciding factor when they come over, getting them the appropriate help so they can communicate with their coach and teammates.
One thing I guess we have to look at is specifically like gymnastics. We also look at specifically track and field as a big place where other foreigners come over to be part of that. And you see it in the summer games that there are people training, and then yet they're from another home country, but yet they went to a school in the U.S. for sure. And that recruiting process is interesting. But again, when you talked about the answer being amateur and not losing that status, that's difficult for sure. So you have to constantly be aware of this, and families out there that know that their kids are going to be really striving well athletically, don't mess that up for that chance for them to go to the U.S. For sure and play a sport. What about the whole language barrier when it comes to the classroom, Darnell? What types of things happen there?
You have a kid who is of a certain status, you'll have, like I said, it all comes about, you know, with things he's known and interpreters. So you'll make sure that the school has an interpreter with study hall and all those things. I have somebody that's going around with the kid until they can fluently speak English. Now, most, unlike, you know, America, most foreign countries, you know, have English as a top language. So a lot of the kids can, you know, communicate. You know, but to have an extensive conversation is kind of hard for them. So if they do have areas where they don't understand, or they can just read better off, you know, of a paper than from hearing from a kid, then they'll just be able to sit in class themselves. But if they need a lot of help, the school will get them an interpreter and a specific study hall person, and they may have more mandatory required hours for study hall based on what they need, you know, from an English standpoint and from a communication standpoint.
I think that's very, very important in anything. Are we missing anything else for our international students out there that they have
to think about? Just making sure they look at the courses that they may want to take part in and move them forward, because I understand when they come here, they still have to be a student, have to still do well in class. So making sure they take courses that are going to benefit them, you know, which is the biggest thing. So they want to use, you know, the internet to go online and to help them prepare, you know, academically for getting the right type of courses in line so that they can then, you know, be good in school. The last thing they want to do is come over here and have no idea what they want to do for their particular, you know, school. Don't get in the right type of classes, and now they're really struggling because they're taking a lot of classes they should not be in.
All right, where's the best place to find you, Darnell, learn more about you, and check you out? Where can they go?
People can go to dangerousethictraining.com to find out about our camps. We got a women's boot camp coming up December 6th. It's going to really be powerful. Helping ladies after Thanksgiving. They work on them trouble areas, their hips, thighs, abs, get them right. We got our big SAT camp meal that's coming up. There's been so much response. The people coming from all over. People want to have SAT tutoring from 6 to 7. We're going to go 3 weeks of math, 3 weeks of reading, and really get kids prepared. But more importantly, from 7 to 9, we're going to go into that field and work on fundamentals of the game and get these kids prepared both academically and athletically. Anything else, they can go to Darnell_Dinkins and follow me on Twitter, or go to Ethic_training and follow us on Twitter there. But all we're doing is trying to service kids both academically and athletically in the Western PA, and more importantly, all over. We have speakers tonight at Butler Area High School tonight at 7 p.m., talking about the recruiting process and the academic component. So if anybody's in the area, they can come there as well. But more importantly, they can continue to follow us at and go to our website, dingusethictraining.com, for more information.
All right, Darnell, good talking to you, and we'll talk soon, man.
Great talking with you, Neil.
All right, take care. All right, you're listening to The Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. Well, an unbelievable show we had tonight. Again, go to my website, TotalTutor.net, for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook. And when I think about the great authors from the Miami Book Fair and the award-winning and acclaimed authors, it's just an honor to be able to cover the Miami Book Fair every year. And now going into the live event this upcoming weekend, where I will kind of celebrating almost 5 years of radio and such amazing interviews. It just makes me look back and listen to myself and say, wow, what have I learned in this 5 year journey? Not saying this journey's over, but I tell you right now, these next 5 years are going to be even more tremendous, as I am going to look, as I said, to have the best celebrity show in the world. Some huge celebrities lined up for the next couple weeks in December as we're journeying. The best author show in the world and the best education show in the world. I've gone through reflection, through some changes in my entrepreneurial spirit. And I really believe what we have been able to do for 5 years has been an amazing ride. Now it's time to take it to the next level. And I want my listeners out there to let me know where you think it needs to go. Yeah, email me, nhaley@totaltutor.org. And let me know. Tweet me @TotalTutor. What celebrity are you waiting to have interviewed next? I mean, also working with the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, and then Dan DeLuca was fantastic. And talking and working with Disney now. I mean, it's just amazing where we have gone from the first days that I tried to do my own show in my studio, or the days of the Total Education Hour in WRCT, to where we are today. Amazing. And then my partnership with Darnell Dinkins, who could believe the bring in an athlete and mix it with education, and we got a rocking old show. And he's amazing. He's a great guy. You got to go to DinkinsEthicTraining.com, and you'll be quite amazed at his knowledge and scope and sequence of how he trains athletes and stuff like that. Again, go to DinkinsEthicTraining.com. And then you look at these great authors like Kai Bird, and him talking about specifically enough the CIA and researching these things. This is the amazing stuff that you find on this show. And listeners out there, I truly, like I said, now I have a goal in mind for the next 5 years. I want to be an award-winning journalist. this is the next step that we're looking at. We're looking at a world winning journalist. We're looking at best-selling author. These are the things that I am going after in the next 5 years in my career, I guess, in the media. So who is that next interview? Who is going to be that next person to sit down and talk to me? That's going to be exciting. What was that number one interview? And then education-wise, we are not afraid to cover education topics that are just amazing. So celebrity fans out there, you want to listen to some interesting things about what's going on in education. One thing we're going to do with bringing down the line with these celebrities is we're going to really talk education with them. We're really going to talk about their lives, their livelihood, their careers. I was watching today on TV Tim McCarver, and Tim was talking about specifically, he was interviewing Steve Largent. And I said, I've had those kind of players on, and I've interviewed them. Well, that's what I want to be able to do. And that's the key component again. So all these great things are happening. I'm very proud of where we're going, and we're taking it to the next level. So everyone have a great day. We'll talk tomorrow. More great, I guess, education and celebrity talk. Good day, everyone.